Slate's coverage of food systems is made possible in part by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Welcome to Slate's Table to Farm. I'm Laura Anderson, Slate's food and drink editor, and joining me here in New York is my co-host Dan Pashman, the host of the Sporkful Food Podcast. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Laura.
So each week in this series, we pick a different food, we learn about it, we cook it, and we eat it. This week is eggs. Coming up later, we're going to be talking to some people who raise chickens that lay eggs in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. But for now, we are delighted to be joined by Peter Singer, who is a professor of bioethics at Princeton University. He's also the author of Animal Liberation, The Way We Eat, and most recently, The Life You Can Save. He joins us now from Princeton, New Jersey. Peter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Laura. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So let's talk about where most of the eggs sold in America come from. Can you describe a little bit what conditions are like for the hens that are laying those eggs?
The hens that lay the overwhelming majority of eggs sold in the United States spend their entire lives inside big sheds, but not just inside those sheds, but inside small wire cages within those sheds. And they're extremely crowded inside those cages. In fact, in a standard size cage, a single bird alone in the cage would not be able to fully extend her wingspan. But the cages don't just house one bird. They has four, five, or six birds. So they're all crammed into that space. And they're rubbing up against each other. They can't get away from each other at all. They're rubbing against the wire. That means that by the time they've been in these cages for a few months, and they're going to be in these cages for at least a year, sometimes for 18 months without ever getting out of them. They only get out to be killed. By the time they've been in there for a few months, they will be losing feathers. Their skin will be rubbed raw against the wire. Another thing to think about is that they're just living on a bare wire floor. They have no nesting area or place to lay their egg in except just to drop it on the wire floor. And hens have an instinctive desire to lay an egg in a sheltered, protected place. Give them a few pieces of straw and they'll start to build a nest before they lay their egg. So even though these birds have never actually been outside or on grass, they still have instincts to behave as the original wild ancestors of today's hens would have behaved. And those instincts are just constantly frustrated.
So that sounds obviously pretty horrifying. It seems counterintuitive that keeping hens in such crowded conditions and denying them their basic instincts would allow producers to get as many eggs as possible out of them. How is it possible that this is the most economically efficient way to get eggs from chickens?
The producers don't have to get as many eggs as possible from each individual hen in order to make the most money possible. The chickens are cheap, and the cages and the shed and the mechanics that go with it, because, of course, these eggs are all automatically collected. There's mechanization. There are conveyor belts that take the feed to the hens that collect the eggs. The eggs roll down to the front of the cage because the wire force slopes. So that's what's expensive, setting up this system. And you could set up the system so that each hen had more space, and each hen would then lay more eggs and certainly would be less likely to die during a year in the cages than they are now. But it's been shown by studies by agricultural economists that you make more money per shed if you put more birds in the shed, even if you get a lower rate of productivity for each individual bird. In other words, the birds don't really matter.
Now, Peter, I'm sure there's a lot of folks out there who are listening to you and they're saying, oh, I buy free-range eggs, so this doesn't concern me. How reliable is the free-range label, and does that solve these concerns?
There are actually virtually no commercial free-range eggs in the United States. Probably what they mean when they say they buy free-range eggs is they buy cage-free eggs. There's a difference. Cage-free eggs are not in the cages that I described, but they are still kept indoors in long sheds with maybe 10,000 birds in a single shed, quite crowded on the floor. Some of them, the ones that label their eggs organic, may give them some space outside during good weather. But I've been inside sheds where the producers are selling organically labeled eggs, and the doors were closed from October until April or something like that. They were closed for the winter months. And even when they were open, there was a very small bare area of dirt with no food, and the birds were not very interested in going outside, as they would have been if they had a large area of grass, place to roam around, scratch the dirt or look for insects, something like that. That would be different. And that's genuine free range, when birds are really given access to a significant grassed area for the majority of the daylight hours. That does happen, but it's tiny in terms of egg production in the United States. It's really minuscule.
And do you think, however small that percentage of the eggs in the country may be, do you think that eating those eggs still is ethically problematic?
It's not ideal, because in any commercial system, once the hen stops laying, she's going to get killed. No producer is going to keep feeding hens who have stopped laying. And so the hens will be killed maybe when they're 2 or 3 years old, whereas they could live to 7 or 10 years even. Also, the male chicks of these breeds will be killed immediately after hatching, because male laying hens are no use to anyone. They don't put on flesh fast enough to be sold for meat. So it's not that there are no problems at all, but I think on balance you could argue that the hens that are there while they live have a reasonably decent life if they are really genuinely free range. And you could say, okay, that's not too bad a deal. We get their eggs, they get this reasonable life outside with a moderately sized flock, not with thousands of birds, but with a few hundred perhaps. So I don't really have a big problem with that. I think that's probably about the most ethically acceptable form of commercial animal product, whether meat, eggs, or milk, that you could buy in the United States.
Peter, I listened to you talk about a lot of the way that so many of these animals are treated, and I certainly make an effort to buy meat that comes from animals that have been treated humanely as possible, but I can't pretend to always succeed in that goal. And when I learn more about the way some of these animals are treated, it makes me feel bad. And it seems to me, I don't know if this applies to me so much, but perhaps as we look at the animal rights movement moving forward, and you've been an integral part of that movement for so many years, it seems to me that guilt is a bad way to motivate people to change their behavior. When you motivate people through guilt, they tend to resent you for it. And if they change their ways, the change tends not to stick. And one of the issues that I think the animal rights movement faces as it becomes more mainstream is that the appeal it makes ends up making people feel guilty for their choices. And then people resent the movement for making them feel that way. Do you think that that's a valid concern? And if so, how do you think it could be addressed?
I'm not sure that it's valid. There may be some people who feel the way you say, but there are also a lot of people who have actually changed their diet. They've become vegetarian or vegan, and they don't feel guilty anymore, and they feel great about their life, about the food they eat, and they feel healthy and vigorous, and they know that they're not contributing to unnecessary animal suffering. And incidentally, they also know that they're minimizing their greenhouse gas emissions. And that's an important reason now why more people are switching to a animal-free or low animal product diet. So, if there's a better way of doing this, I think these changes are necessary. I think they're ethically important, both for animals and for the environment and the climate. So if there's a better way of getting people to make that switch, tell me about it. But until we find a better way, I think all we can do is present people with the facts, give them the ethical arguments, and leave it up to them to get rid of their guilt feelings by doing the right thing.
Do you think that someday, possibly after we are all dead, everyone in the world will be vegan? And if so, how do you think we're going to get there?
I don't really know about everyone in the world, because maybe there will still be tribal people living in Alaska or living in the Kalahari who will want to maintain that tribal way of life and will not be able to do so without killing some animals as part of that. And, really, that doesn't bother me so much. I mean, it's the literally, billions and billions, maybe it's 50 billion animals a year that are being killed from industrial farms. That's what really bothers me. And I do think that we'll get to that being a thing of the past, that future generations will look back on that in horror and say, how could people, you know, apparently intelligent, civilized people do such a thing, know where their food was coming from and still buy it? You know, just as we now look back at the Romans say these seem to be civilized people who had great poets and orators and historians and so on. How could they go and enjoy an afternoon in which they watched Christians being torn apart by lions? I think people will look back on what we're doing in that way.
Let's say that you could wave a wand and make it possible for all foods in the world to be produced with no suffering whatsoever in a truly ethical manner. What would be the first thing you'd eat?
This is not totally impossible as far as meat is concerned, because there are people working on in vitro meat, which is just grown from a single cell of an animal, which is obviously not suffering, and then grown in vitro. So if people could do that, I don't know. Look, I haven't really eaten meat for more than 40 years now. I don't have any great desire to rush out and have a steak or a burger or something like that. I mean, maybe it would be interesting to see what lobster tastes like again. I used to occasionally enjoy some lobster before I became a vegetarian. But that's not a big deal. Actually, I'd really much rather have a good ripe mango, I think, than anything in the meat or fish variety.
So that's interesting. So I'm a vegetarian. I eat dairy and eggs. Dan is not a vegetarian. I feel similarly to how you just described. I don't crave meat. You know, it's just like I can really take it or leave it. I don't really care that much. But I definitely know some people who physically they feel like they need a lot of protein. Meat just takes up a much more important role in their diet than mine. And I feel like it's hard for me to, not knowing what it's like to live in their body, it is hard for me to tell them that they should not be eating meat, knowing that they might suffer quite a bit more than I do in giving it up. And I realize, even saying this now, that like suffering, the suffering of not eating meat is nothing compared to the suffering of the animals that are being tortured in factory farms. But do you think that there's any credence to the argument that people need to know their own bodies, know what diet is best for them, and then adhere to that?
Yeah, there's something in that. I mean, I don't know. I'm a bit puzzled because I grew up in Australia, which is a country that, you know, is a big meat producer, has good quality meat, fairly cheap. For my graduate work, so when I was in my early 20s, I went to Oxford. And for the first sort of, 6 or 9 months or something, you know, along with other Australians I knew there, we complained about the quality of meat in England. Ah, such bad meat here, you can't get, and it's so expensive. And then for completely different reasons, I got convinced of the ethical arguments and became a vegetarian. And I didn't really miss meat nearly as much as I thought I would, despite that. And, maybe it took a couple of months, but I made the adjustment pretty well. Now, maybe there are other people for whom meat was also central, whose bodies don't adjust to it as well. I've certainly had people tell me that. And if that's the case, then I'm sympathetic and I hope they can find alternative foods that do nourish them well and that they feel well with. So, I should be concerned. And you know, maybe the development of in vitro meat is eventually going to solve this problem. I hope so.
Peter Singer, thank you so much for joining us. Peter Singer is a professor of bioethics at Princeton University and the author of Animal Liberation, most recently The Life You Can Save, and also The Way We Eat, which takes a similar journey and approach to what we're doing here. So thank you so much for joining us. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you, Laura and Dan. Thanks. It's been good talking to both of you.
Well, Laura, it was certainly an honor to speak with Peter Singer, although I have to say, with all due respect to the esteemed professor, I disagree with one of the points that he made regarding my concern about guilt. I do think that, look, clearly there are some people who hear that animals are being mistreated and it makes them feel guilty and it makes them change their ways and they feel better. I'm sure Professor Singer is right that happens all the time. And he sort of acknowledged that guilt is the motivating factor. I just think that as we look to how is this movement, this concern for the welfare of animals, as it becomes more mainstream, there are certain types of people who, when they are made to feel guilty about something, they think, well, gee, I need to change my ways. But there are other people who, when you come to them and say, you know, this thing you're doing is actually kind of mean and having all these negative consequences. Some people respond by saying, screw you, don't call me a jerk. I'm not a jerk. People get defensive. And that's unfortunate. And so I do think that that is a barrier. I think that some people are closed. They don't want to consider these problems because it makes them feel guilty and they don't want to deal with that.
I think you're definitely right, but I wonder what the alternative is. I think the problem is that we have so many emotions tied up with food already. People feel guilt about eating a piece of chocolate cake. I mean, that's not guilt about where it came from or who was harmed in the making of that chocolate cake. It's just that we have this idea that chocolate cake is sinful and bad. Everyone has emotions tied up in food. I don't know if there's any way that you're ever going to be able to talk completely rationally about food without having people get upset at you.
Maybe, but I think the reason why people consider chocolate cake to be quote unquote sinful is because they think it's bad for them. It's unhealthy. And so in other words, it runs counter to their own self-interest. So I think maybe that for those other people who aren't going to be swayed by guilt, that's another approach is to say, look, this is healthier for you. It's better for you and it's going to taste better, be more delicious. It's better for the environment. Like it's just make it a positive message. Don't make it, you know, do you see what you're doing to the animals? Instead, make it like, look at this. Taste a bite of this chicken. How good does this taste? Because this chicken was treated well. To me, of all the foods that you could spend extra money on to get local, organic, well-treated eggs, farmers market eggs, the difference in quality is so noticeable. I love those eggs. So to me, it's like just if everyone could just eat those eggs, then I think the problem would go away because they would say we need these eggs for everyone.
I mean, you're right. They are delicious. But as a vegetarian, I have to say I still kind of have mixed feelings about eating eggs. It's not quite as bad as the mixed feelings I have about eating dairy, which we can talk about later in our dairy episode. But as Peter Singer pointed out, if you're going to raise chickens just for their eggs, you're still going to have a whole bunch of male chicks that you're going to have to kill off or just feed out of the goodness of your heart in order to keep them alive. And that's unlikely to happen.
So as long as you've been a vegetarian, did you always eat eggs?
Well, for a while, I was a vegan when I was in high school for a few years. And I have to say, I didn't miss the taste of eggs. I just missed how useful they were. You can use them in so many ways. I mean, baking is the obvious example. But even if you're just looking for a protein-rich vegetarian main dish, there are so many ways that you can cook eggs. And they all taste different and they're all delicious. I kind of miss that.
And so was that the driving force? I mean, what was the thought process when you went from vegan back to vegetarian and started eating eggs again? How did you rationalize that to yourself?
That's a good question. I think I've like blocked that out of my memory. it was too much hypocrisy to deal with. No, I think I just realized I wasn't eating a very balanced diet as a vegan. Obviously, it's possible to eat a balanced diet as a vegan. I just wasn't really. I was eating a ton of starch and sugar and not very much protein, and I didn't feel that good. It was also I really missed cheese.
Listeners can't see that a single tear just trickled down Laura's cheek as she said that.
These days I buy eggs all the time. I get them from the farmer's market. Sometimes I also get them in my CSA. It's the next best thing to having chickens laying eggs in your backyard, I think.
Which is something I've always wanted to do, but I mean, between dealing with a two-year-old and not having a yard or the time, I don't have the chicken coop quite up and running yet. But we actually went and talked to some people who do. They're out in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn at the Bed-Stuy Campaign Against Hunger, which is a great organization that's doing a lot of good work in the community there to help people in need in a variety of ways, including providing free food to people who need it. And they actually set up a little farm and chicken coop, and they're giving out the eggs. And so we went out to meet them. We spoke with Raleigh Hernandez, who's an older gentleman who's in charge of overseeing the chickens and the garden. We spoke with Tamara Dawson. She's the program director for Bed-Stuy Campaign Against Hunger. And we also spoke with a teenager named Denroy Stoner, better known to them as Champs. He joined us for a question or two.
We're witnessing some chicken throwing here.
Yeah, throwing is a strong word.
Tossing.
Gentle tossing.
Gentle tossing of chickens.
They seemed unfazed.
They didn't seem to mind at all.
What we should make clear is that we're on Fulton Street.
Right, which is a pretty busy thoroughfare.
It runs the better part of the length of or width of Brooklyn through many different neighborhoods. And if you walked by the front of this place, it would look like another one of the brownstones or storefronts that you see all for many miles along Fulton Street.
It is a pretty unassuming front of the building.
And yes. You come around the back and there's a farm. There's a little tiny farm with chickens.
With chickens.
And rows of vegetables. And so, Raleigh, What's growing here?
Kale and collard greens.
Do you get different plants in the summer?
Yes. Oh, we have tomatoes, eggplant, corn, rosemary, peppermint, cucumbers, cabbage, a lot of stuff.
Everything.
Yeah. Carrots, okra. Yes.
He's not underneath
the... He's always there, but he can't come in, remember?
Yeah.
Can't come in.
Sorry.
Oh, is that the cat?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you got a... Is that your cat?
No.
Two wild cats.
There's two wild cats? And you got a... So you're protecting the coop?
Yes, yes, yes.
Wait, have
yes.
you ever lost a chicken to a cat?
No. No.
But they would, that's what they're after. They
yes,
would
but
like
I think the cat, the chicken are too big. They might fight the cat. But the cat is still
these
dangerous.
Are some pretty big chickens. It's yeah. true. These chickens are at least as big as a cat.
Yes. And we started the coop back in about July. When we got them, when you get the chicken, you don't know what sex they are right mm-hmm. away, especially when they're younger. And it's illegal for you to have roosters in the midst. So we had to get rid of the roosters. We gave them away.
So why is it illegal to have roosters?
Crowing.
Oh, I guess that makes sense. I guess I would not really want to live next to someone who had a rooster in the backyard yeah. crowing a dog every morning.
It's funny that, you know, in some of the things you guys have to worry about are exactly the same that a farmer in the middle of nowhere is going to worry about. You got to guard your hen house, just yeah. like anyone. But then you also got to worry about noise complaints for the rooster. So exactly. in some ways, it's a little different from the farm.
Exactly, exactly.
So I'm going to talk find out from you guys how you got into this. So, Champs, can I ask you, how old are you?
16.
And you say you've been doing this for 2 years?
Yes.
Champs actually started as one of our green teens. Our green teens is one of the programs that we offer here at Bed-Stuy, Campaign Against Hunger. He's not too much into the growing process, but we found that he loved the chickens, working with the chickens, and he's very dedicated. And having chickens teaches young people responsibilities, and so he's been very responsible and dedicated.
And Raleigh, did you have a background in working with animals and working with farming?
I was born in Trinidad, so my job when I was a little kid, like 10 years old, to take care of the chickens, the ducks, the turkeys, pigs, you know, all that stuff. So when I came here for food, and then they had on the bulletin board about gardening, and I went to the garden and I start doing a little work on the garden, and they keep me on, started to come back. And I suffered from depression because I had prostate cancer. So the cancer, the radiation got me into depression. So it was very, very good for me, and I felt good. It helps me to reconnect with nature. It was very good for me.
Tell me a little more about the impact that working here has had on your life.
It has helped me psychologically. And I say, like, again, it helps me battle depression. And I feel a better person, more spiritually inclined now, and more peaceful and more in tune with myself. Because I'm 64 years old, right? So, you know, I'm retired. It's something to do, and it helps me, it helps the garden and the chickens and the community at large.
Is there anything different about farming and raising chickens in New York compared to Trinidad?
Yes, because now it's cold. See, in Trinidad, it was always warm, so it's easier.
And, you know, a lot of times when I talk to folks who've come here from other countries where the food supply system is more local, they come here and it's like, you know, certain foods just don't taste the same as they did back home. The eggs, they just don't taste the same, right? And did you have that experience when you came here from Trinidad?
Yes, of course.
And now that you're here raising these chickens, do you feel like you're getting that some of that Trinidad flavor in the eggs?
Trinidad flavor, and also feel like I'm reliving my youth again, my childhood, and it's all good to me.
So if you eat these eggs compared to eggs that you would buy at the supermarket, what is different about them?
It tastes better.
Do they look different?
They do taste better and they do look different. If you crack the egg open, there's a difference in the firmness of the yolk. Not the yolk, but the white part of the egg. Also, the color of the yolk is a little more oranger because of the naturalness of the chickens. They are able to freely, as you see, they're able to freely roam. They're able to scratch and dig up their worms and things of that nature.
Hey, it's Laura. I'm interrupting for a second because at this point in the interview, we were joined by a woman named Claire Lynch, who is the AmeriCorps Vista volunteer for Bed-Stuy Campaign Against Hunger. And Claire started telling us about what it was like when the chickens were just chicks and they kept them inside the office.
Well, we kept them inside the office so that we could keep track of them. I mean, people would be coming through and, you know, you're dealing with people who don't have, can't put enough food on their tables. And in the background, you hear that little peeping. It somehow makes it seem a little bit more manageable. I would also just like to say that we frequently have, school groups that come to visit. And so the chickens get the pleasure of meeting, and other kids get the pleasure of meeting the chickens. And when I have a school group or some other group that's coming in to volunteer in the garden, it's the first thing that I show them, and they automatically perk up. And within a few minutes, they're over there shoveling the dirt and getting, like, the nutritious soil ready that we need for planting in the spring. So it's a source of inspiration and good manure.
You can't ask for much more than that.
I think it's not necessarily widely known that in many cities you can keep chickens. It's becoming more well known, but it was a surprise to me when I learned that it's totally legal to keep chickens in New York City.
Do you guys know other people around the neighborhood who keep chickens?
The Amani Garden, they have like 57 chickens. Rescue Mission has like 17.
And do they come to you, Raleigh, for advice on how to take care of them?
Yes, some of them, yes. Yeah.
You're like the mayor of the chickens of Bed-Stuy.
I want to be called, George Washington Carver of chickens.
Right, George Washington Carver of chickens, right? Well, you're on your way. It seems like you're on your way.
Yeah, I'm learning. I'm still studying too.
So we're going to be cooking some eggs. I want each of you guys to tell me what your favorite way to eat eggs is.
I would say that poached with something like sautéed mushrooms.
I'm a boiled egg person.
You get a better taste when you boil it. But you scramble with peppers is good, too.
Oh, I like fried eggs with bacon and cheese.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I can't believe I had to get to the fourth person before I heard the word bacon and cheese. What's going on here? Okay. All right, well, we're back in the studio here. Laura, I know you pointed out earlier that, yeah, you can do so many wonderful things with eggs. You've made a lovely frittata here for us. You'll be sharing the recipe on the show page, but tell us about it.
Well, so I feel like frittatas are very likely the best thing that you can do with eggs, possibly the best thing you can do with any edible ingredient. they're so versatile. You can put any vegetable in a frittata. You can also put like leftover pasta in a frittata. You can put leftover anything in a frittata. You can use pretty much any kind of cheese or no cheese at all. And all you have to do is just like beat up some eggs and like pour them over whatever you want to put in the frittata and like bake it for 20 minutes in the oven. You end up with this amazing pie that is incredibly satisfying and filling and nutritious, and leftovers are amazing. It tastes great cold or at room temperature. I don't know what else to say except the frittatas are just my very favorite thing to do with eggs.
Have you ever put leftover frittata into a frittata?
I've never put leftover frittata into a frittata. Have you ever put leftover frittata into a frittata?
Not yet.
This frittata that we're eating right now is it has kale in it. Kale is a great thing to put in a frittata. I often find myself, when I have green vegetables, leafy green vegetables in the fridge, frittata, first thing I think to make with them. My favorite sort of cheese to use with greens is feta. It just gets this amazing sort of like almost like squeaky consistency when you bake it. It's very, very dense and, of course, wonderfully salty. And you just get these distinct little pockets of feta in the frittata, which, unlike Parmesan or another melting cheese, those just sort of like fade into the eggs. But feta stays distinct, and I really like that.
I think that's a great way to describe it. I think that we also need to start a band called Pockets of Feta.
You're in. What do you play?
I'll just be eating the feta. Is that an instrument?
Sure, you get that like sort of like squeaky feta noise.
Yeah, when you're... It's going to be at least as good as the Gregorian chant.
We've got Dan Pashman on squeaky feta noise. I can play tambourine. Yeah.
How could it go wrong? This can't fail. No, this is really delicious, Laura. You did a great job.
Thank you, Dan. So that about does it for us this week. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Laura.
You can find a link to the recipe for the frittata that we just ate on our show page. You can also find links to other things on our show page. You can check out Dan's podcast at Sporkful.com. And be sure to tune in next week when we will be talking about beef. And we will be interviewing a butcher who has been butchering meat since he was 12 years old and who works at a shop that has been in the same location in Brooklyn for almost a century.
And then we're going to eat meat. Or at least I will.
I'm not going to eat meat. I will be bringing in like a handful of sunflower seeds into the butcher shop.
Well, I'll eat beef for both of us then.
Okay, sounds like a plan.